Strategic Wealth Management Podcast. If you haven't already clicked to subscribe, please do so. New episodes come out monthly. And we're here to talk about today the conclusion of our 250 Days of Innovation in the United States series. And then we're also going to talk about the rest of 2026 and some topics about the market. This is John Patika Jr., and I'm here with John Patika Sr., and one of the architects from the Innovation Series has been a repeat guest on our podcast, Kurt Ryman from our Chief Investment Office. And Kurt, thanks for joining us today.
That's good to be with you. Thanks for the invitation and putting the spotlight on the 250 years of U.S. Innovation Series. Appreciate it.
I know you guys put a lot of work into it. And as history guys over here, I mean, we really enjoyed reading it, the publications and could you describe some of the common, features you and your team kind of unearthed across doing the 250 years of innovation?
Yeah, sure. It's, the reason why we did this is that we're going through, it seems, a pretty important technological transformation right now. So we wanted to learn from the past and understand from that what lessons might apply. And also, coming into this 250-year celebration of the U.S., we wanted to change the discussion a little bit. We thought that the, the sort of discourse around the U.S. was shifting in a way that didn't feel quite right. Wanted to kind of get a little bit somewhat patriotic, but also positive about the features of the U.S. that have gotten us to where we are today. So I guess what I'd say is that not all innovations or even inventions are going to succeed. So the reason why we, talked about the 10 innovations in this report series, they did succeed. But at the beginning, it wasn't obvious. And I think that's really critical. Innovations that seem we take for granted today, like, getting on an airplane or plugging our iPhone in to get charged or even having an iPhone, with the semiconductors and the connections to the internet, all themes that we talked about, these weren't guaranteed at the beginning. And yet we have capital markets in the U.S. that were able to allow these technologies to scale. That scale didn't just come from capital markets. There was also pretty consistently a role that government played in whether it was procurement or meaning the purchases of either, think about planes in the war period or some of the money that or land grants that were offered for the Transcontinental Railroad. Some of the early investments in semiconductors and the internet, these were all ways that the government contributed to bringing these technologies to a point where they scaled and were able to succeed. The ideas themselves weren't invented necessarily by the government. That's not the point. It's just that there was some role to getting these off the ground, so to speak. And then I guess I'd also say Americans had to overcome fears. It's not like these technologies were like today with AI and some of the concerns about whether it's going to take people's jobs or whether the data centers are causing harm to local communities. That's not new. Americans, people worldwide thought that their organs would liquefy if they went at speeds over 30 miles an hour on a train. Think about electrification and the battle of the currents when there were different competing ideas. Was it the DC or AC current? And the proponents of those used fear to promote their own technology. Getting on airplanes, that's something that people fear even still today, but the fact that the government was helping the airplane industry adapt and evolve and iteratively improve the technology over several decades, part of it through the war era, meant that by the 40s, the transatlantic flight was something that more Americans were willing to embark on. And that just created this, you know, transportation wave in the travel and tourism industry. So getting over fears, that's not new. It's just that I think Americans have a greater willingness to adapt and to change. And that enables the technology also to scale. So we're, you know, the conclusion is, I guess, is that Americans are all in on transformational technology in a way that other countries are not. And that has meant that the gains from those technologies have turned out to show up in earnings. It's not a straight line. There's always setbacks. That's also something that we can conclude from the series. Boom and bust cycles, overinvestment, excess capacity. This is not the exception, it's the rule. It happens every single time. But if you invest early and you stay the course, more often than not, the rule is that you end up having outsized returns in the portfolio. Entry points matter, but if you get in early, you identify those companies. It can also be in the public markets. It's not that you have to be an early venture capital stage investor, but getting in early and staying the course, not giving up, is critical. Just one last point is that, you know, you think on this path, many of us will remember investing in the dot-com era. And it just seemed like at the time, if you put money in the NASDAQ, let's say in 2000, you had to wait over a decade for that loss to turn into a gain. But then look what happened from 2016 to 2026. The NASDAQ went parabolic. Time in the market matters more than timing the market. We've heard that adage, but that's really relevant. It's truly relevant when it comes to investing in transformational innovation. So I'll leave it there. Hopefully that, you know, kind of helps set the table a bit.
No, it does. But let's take that a little bit farther now that the new technology is really scaling up. And can you relate that to some of the lessons of the past? I know you touched on it there. Can we go a little deeper on that? What did they learn in the, what have you learned by studying this that might relate to the scale up we're doing?
Right. Today with artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, yeah. So first off, you know, the capital markets piece, you need capital to scale ideas, and adaptation happens, it seems, faster and faster with each new technology. You know, think about how hard it was initially with the Transcontinental Railroad to scale across. Before you had the migration of people into the heartland and the ability to take that economic gain from the heartland and send goods out to the coast and vice versa, you had to scale mountains. There were enormous obstacles. It was a big infrastructure build out. It was built out over years, and the adoption of the railroads took decades. Compare that to today. 50% of people, either at home or at work, can say that they are already using generative AI, which has only been around for 2 years. Admittedly, you do need infrastructure, and that's, you know, the data centers, which contain servers and semiconductors, and you need the models and the information layer. But the update, so you as a user, happens instantaneously. You as a user really don't need new technology. It'll operate on your current computer, on your iPhone, or your Android device. It's a system that people can adapt rapidly, and they're doing it. Now, the more rapid it happens and the more agentic or the more work that these AI agents have to do, the more infrastructure you need. So that's the capital markets are moving as rapidly as the adoption, and it's faster than ever. And so you have this situation where just a couple of years ago, the large tech companies weren't issuing a whole lot of debt. And now you have over $100 billion in debt issuance in just 1 year. And you compare also the fact that companies were able to use their cash flow to finance the expansion of AI, but now they've quickly had to shift from using cash flow to other forms of securitization. Now, it may be that they're doing senior unsecured debt. They might also be doing secured project finance debt. It may be investment grade. It may be high yield. But they're tapping a large range of financial products. And the U.S. has that that facility, that ease, more than other countries. You think about Europe, it's more of a banking type of relationship. Asia, a lot of this is state sponsored or subsidized. The U.S., it's a capital markets driven build out of AI with very minimal government investment. But I think we have to just kind of step back and appreciate just how rapidly this is taking place. And the more rapid it takes place, the more fear and resistance to change you're going to find. And also there are greater questions about whether the income and the earnings are going to accrue, the efficiencies are going to accrue to make the investment in these, in this infrastructure pay off. And right now there seems to be, based on the market moves, a consensus that it will pay off. But, you know, the historical record does suggest that these kinds of waves of transformational innovation, they can be messy. They can have, they're not necessarily linear. They can have excesses accrue and build. So it's worth being mindful of that and being aware that this is, you know, this would be one in a string of many transformational innovations that had excess capacity, it wouldn't be an exception. So that's something I think investors need to be paying attention to. It's not that there isn't an opportunity from an investment angle. We think that there is one, very, very clearly think that there is one. But these sorts of things are not preordained. So we have to be mindful of whether this build out is going to generate the earnings on the other side.
You know, Kurt, you wrote about that fear you talked about. You wrote about it as being common in past periods of technology change, rapid technology change. I want you to give me a couple examples of that. And then I also want to slip into the current AI again, the fear. We're seeing politicians get involved, some of them sincerely, some of them just trying to score a vote. But we're seeing a lot of that around the data centers and even more. So maybe touch on some past fear and then you can go as far as you want. You want to talk about how far the government should get involved here? I mean, let's hear your thoughts.
Sure. So semiconductors, and the internet created the smartphone, and then people are using cell phones and they're worried about getting cancer. So some of the fears are, you know, maybe premature or half-baked ideas. There's also real concerns around recombinant DNA. We talked about how, you know, when you're splicing in genetic makeup into DNA, it can create concerning, potentially life-threatening results. And the bioethicist community and academics and scientists and businesses convened basically a moratorium on the use of recombinant DNA until they had a protocol and a kind of an ethical and moral statement about how it would be used. So, you know, bioethics around the early stage recombinant DNA in the 1970s was a big issue, and it didn't require necessarily government involvement. It was the academic and scientific community that came up with their own sort of, you know, rule book and ways of the road. I talked about the fear of high speeds in a train and fears of flying. I guess we'd also have to consider just in general, like you think about technology, always from the early times when, a hatchet was invented, sure, it made it easier to cut down trees and chop wood, but it also became, potentially a threat from a military perspective or from a threat perspective. That's where we are with AI today. It's, it's a geostrategic concern. It's a, who's going to win the AI race, for example, or could AI be unleashed in a threatening way that would cripple infrastructure to an adversary? Is there the risk that AI turns superhuman? This could be a risk to jobs and people's way of life, the infrastructure, the data centers. People are concerned that it creates noise and other forms of pollution. They worry about their residential electricity prices going up if the data centers are not paying for the additional infrastructure and demands on the generation capacity. These are interesting questions, but they're also happening at the same time that there's all this discussion about national economic policy and our strategy. You think about some of the questions about our military readiness, wanting to return shipbuilding and aluminum smelting and steel generation to the United States, because those industries can be turned to military use. Well, all of those are enormously energy consuming activities. So there are now moratoriums that states are putting in place, kind of call it a pause or a delay, to think about the implications of these large load businesses or industries. Well, if you put too many restraints because you're concerned about data centers, those same constraints might limit other high energy intensive industries that are also consuming a lot of electricity. So I guess development and expansion of industries are always going to run in these, and the fears around them are always going to run into the public sphere, and that's where governments are going to have to start thinking about, do they regulate? Do they overregulate? What role do they play in, helping to, provide for a social fabric and and commerce and so on that people feel comfortable with? Or do they regulate it and it just goes, from one state to another state, from one locality to another locality. And then you compete, the areas that are more receptive end up generating maybe potentially more jobs or more employment opportunities. That's really up to the state and local and federal governments to decide, but they always get involved. The government is at every stage, they get involved. I think the question right now is, government involvement hasn't ever choked off the the scale and the growth and the technology and the earnings that, that would accrue from that. So the question is today is, are they going to do that? And I think the answer is no on data centers and infrastructure. Sure, there are a lot of localities and states that are rejecting data centers, but there's plenty of space and other areas where these data centers can be built. So thinking about that as a constraint on AI, you know, may be premature. So recognizing, of course, that the that some of the you know concerns about pollution, noise pollution, water use, there may be points there, but if states are and local governments are constraining the data centers being built in those areas, they'll get built somewhere else. So to me, it's not necessarily an initial constraint on the build out of AI.
Okay. Kurt, I'm going to go back to your younger days as a fixed income guru and talk a little fixed income here. The borrowing for these data centers and AI build out is massive on a scale. I can't remember ever seeing anything like this. I mean, the Alphabet was talking yesterday about spending $205 billion. Where are they getting this money? They're borrowing it. How does that work when they're borrowing it as a bond form? Or are they getting loans from somebody? How's this working? Maybe you can expand on that thought. I'm looking for risk, obviously.
Yeah. They can build out from their cash flow, and still, you know, a lot of the AI CapEx is coming from cash flow. That's important. We have to keep that in mind. It's been the case so long as they've been building out so far, and it's really just 2025 and 2026 where they've started to increase the debt load. So they're issuing new debt. Their cash balances haven't necessarily declined, so they still have a fairly sizable, kind of cash balance or, if you will, iron reserve. And the CapEx as a share of their cash flow is, is going to be going up. It's not just that we should be thinking about these companies as necessarily concerning, with this debt load. Alphabet's got a, very strong investment grade credit rating. The same is true of most of the other large cloud and tech and AI providers that are issuing debt. Oracle is, on the cusp. So they tend to be viewed as a bit more risky, but that's already reflected in their higher yields on the debt that they issue. So yeah, I mean there's more debt issued. That's that's a consequence of just how fast they feel they need to build up in order to meet the demand for all the computing power that AI is going to need to supply. And I think, they have to be able to generate the earnings from this in order to make the debt issuance still a good idea. There's also, you think about these companies, there's also a risk of not moving. So, we can be concerned that in the sense that they're building out this capacity. That's a risk for sure. But what if they didn't? And so like, what would Google's search business be like if they weren't migrating, to a more AI user interface like they have been? That becomes an obsolescence risk. So not, you know, moving too fast and not moving at all are risks. But, you know, the question is whether they're building out this capability set and moving in a direction that's sustainable. And when you look at the fact that they still have strong cash balances, you know, then it's one that I think is, at least in the near term, maybe even in the intermediate term, is one that, you know, we feel pretty comfortable with.
Well, Kurt, we still have a few more minutes. I wanted to ask you about the Fed and any thoughts on the Fed. Are they going to make any moves this year? Any thought on the new guy?
So it's been a long time since we've had this kind of, I don't want to call it necessarily uncertainty, but for a wide range of opinions about what the Fed's going to do next. They're meeting next week, and it's a decisive meeting. Or just to kind of cut to the chase, maybe provide the answer right up front, and then we go into some of the details around it. We don't think the Fed's going to move rates this year. And we think the next move is a cut is more likely than a hike, which is, I guess, against conventional wisdom at the moment. The market's priced for rate hikes this year. The question of whether they move in July, it's still more likely that they don't raise rates than that they do, but there's still some that think they will. The Fed is in a difficult position. Inflation is uncomfortably high. It's not like the levels we saw a few years ago, but it's away from their target. And it's reasonable to think that the Fed might tolerate somewhat higher inflation than their target because the costs of bringing it down to target are high. But also some of the issues they're dealing with are not necessarily finely tuned for Fed policy. You know, think about the war in Iran and the cost of oil and the energy cost increases that Americans are facing. That's feeding into inflation. It's causing inflation expectations to rise somewhat. But if the Fed raises rates to combat that type of inflation or also tariff related inflation, they're not actually going to do much. That's a pretty weak policy tool. The Fed has more success dealing with inflation that's caused by too high demand, not when it's caused by supply shocks. So then what happens if they raise interest rates a couple times and oil prices are high, maybe they even rise more, and you know, and the economy weakens because of sustained high oil prices? Well, then the Fed just gets blamed for having caused a recession. So I think we're going to see inflation start to moderate into the end of the year. We're already seeing some indication that that's likely to happen, especially in areas like core goods, and that the labor market will not really weaken, but just not be as strong as the year progresses and into the new year, and that should provide an opportunity for the Fed to cut interest rates. So we've had a pretty tough month in the bond market, as you know, we've seen the war escalate again and oil prices rise and inflation expectations rise and more concern that the Fed's going to raise interest rates. That's been building in. That puts some pressure on bonds. It's been a difficult month, but we think that over the course of the year, rates should start to trend back again, and that will take some of the pressure off. Should be still a decent year for fixed income investors. More, it's an income generating year, not one that's boosted by rates falling a lot, but just one where you're clipping your coupon.
Well, I don't want to get too far away from the 250 year report you guys did, but I was watching the World Cup, and you know, they were interviewing all these Europeans, and then did follow-up stories. They were talking about air conditioning, and they couldn't believe how much air conditioning that we have here. And they were talking, their stores don't even have them. And then I remembered a line, and I looked it up, that you wrote in the 250-year report. And you were describing the USA as a constant drive toward improvement. It was a place where the question is not whether something would fail, but whether it might work. And when I see that, I just think about the Europeans, and they say, well, geez, we won't have enough electric, so we better not put the air on, or keep it at 88 degrees or 85 degrees, and then we'll all have enough. I just wanted your comments on that as you wrote this thing. You know, we wouldn't tolerate that, would we?
Yeah, there's been a trend towards adapting new technologies here to the point where in America, you know, we're replacing maybe for the third time the air conditioner when a lot of parts of Europe are just embracing air conditioning for the first time. And I, you know, it's sort of the way that I would describe it is that there are times when in the US we look at things and we say, you know, the best days are in the rearview mirror. I remember back in the 200th anniversary of the US, I was young and was of course naive, but I had this fascination with the Statue of Liberty and everything it stood for. And at the time in the mid 70s, the concerns were about high inflation, about geopolitical crises, having just come off the Vietnam War. There was, you know, this Watergate scandals and a whole host of, you know, the OPEC oil embargoes. There were reasons to be, you know, negative about the outlook for the U.S., but it would have been the wrong call. It was right about that time that recombinant DNA was being invented. The microchip was making its way into personal computing applications. The internet was just really kind of getting born and wouldn't see the practical applications for another 20 years and so on. And all of the investment opportunities from there. And I don't think that the outlook for AI and technology is, you know, a straight line positive from here. There's a lot of work that's going to have to get done in capital markets, in regulation, just how the technologies are applied, the productivity that companies are able to generate, and a lot of iteration, you know, of the technology and innovation from here. So when we think about regulation, you know, is it done in a way that can both, you know, ameliorate the fears and the concerns about change while at the same time not choking off that really important piece, which is finding ways to employ and develop the technology, which we've seen over several decades prior. So I would say, you know, definitely thinking about this, you know, this whole idea of the best days of the U.S. are behind us. For that, I would say, you know, double check the historical record, because usually that kind of prediction is wrong. But at the same time, you know, not taking it for granted, right? Not taking for granted that things are just going to happen requires a lot of hard work. It requires discussion in a public sphere, and it requires all stakeholders working together to make sure that you know, that it works. So that's what I learned from thinking about all of this, you know, wonderful historical record that the U.S. has provided. And it's been it's just a great exercise working with all of our super talented analysts and strategists at the CIO who brought these to life. And by the way, also thanks to you guys for being one of the first when we started this series to write in to us and say how cool you thought that the reports were, because it's that kind of it's that kind of reaction that gives us the motivation to keep going. So yeah, it's been great working with you guys, and thanks for putting the spotlight on it.
Thanks, Kurt. And you know, if anyone would like to have any of the reports that Kurt and his team have produced on the innovation series, you can go to our website, and UBS actually has a dedicated website to go to the 250 years of innovation in the United States. And you guys created a really cool video going through all the different innovations, which I thought was pretty neat too. And so we just want to thank you, Kurt, you and your team, for all the hard work that you guys did through this. And any final thoughts before we go?
Stay cool. have a nice weekend. And yeah, thanks again for the opportunity to join you.
Yeah, appreciate it, Kurt. Thanks for being with us here.
Thanks, Kurt. Right.
Yep, you bet.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.